Are you someone who enjoys a good glass of wine but is never sure just what to get? Indulge your inner oenophile and take the guesswork out of wine by signing up for the National Review Wine Club. All of our wines are selected by a team with more than 150 years of collective experience buying, judging, and making wine. We weed through the thousands of wines out there to select the very best of the best and deliver it straight to your door, all at an unbeatable price. Not only that, the Wine Club is also a great way to support our valuable conservative journalism here at National Review. A portion of every order goes to helping us grow our team and editorial impact. And there's no time better than today. Our introductory special delivers four of our hand-selected wines straight to your door for only $29.99. So head over to nationalreviewwineclub.com today and get ready to kick back with an exquisite bottle of wine in the comfort of your own home.
Hello and welcome to another episode of National Review's Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bonson. I am so excited. Another first-time guest this week. So let's see. I think last week we had Dr. Andrew Abella for the first time from Catholic University of America, the Bush School of Business. The week before, we had Paul Hatch, the former vice chairman at Morgan Stanley. And then before that, we had Ash Bennington, author of a new hit book about the fall of the crypto empire FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried, who has since then been convicted of all charges. So we've just had kind of a string of just really exciting, fun episodes lately, all with first-time guests. And today is another one, both fun, both exciting, and first-time guest, Barry Ritholtz. Barry is the founder and CEO at Ritholtz Wealth Management. He is a well-known media figure, hosts his own podcast, Masters of the Universe, at Bloomberg, is a frequent writer, well-known, has written a couple of books, including the book Bailout Nation that came out after the financial crisis. And across different financial media within our industry, Barry is a well-known pundit, does run another private wealth management firm, very similar to the firm that I run, the Bonson Group. Barry and I have struck up a friendship here in New York City. I am fond of him, his insights, his communication skills, and I'm just really excited to have him on the podcast. But I'll tell you what else is kind of fun. Barry is not one of us. And what I mean by that, Barry is not a movement conservative. I don't think he's a lifetime National Review guy. I don't think he uses terms like I do a lot in this podcast, like free and virtuous society. I think he would be more accurately called a centrist, maybe center-left, maybe moderate, whatever. But he's not a movement conservative guy. And yet, he's my friend. And he's going to be a guest on our podcast today. And the rest we'll leave up to you to digest, to either love what he has to say or be upset that I would dare have someone of a different point of view on the podcast. But I think you'll get a lot out of it. I'm excited to have Barry on. Let's get into it. So with that said, allow me to welcome yet another first-time guest to National Review's Capitol Record, Barry Ritholtz. Barry, welcome to Capitol Record.
Thank you so much for having me, David. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you. I have been listening to your podcast on Bloomberg for a long, long time. And I hope that a lot of our listeners are familiar with you, but maybe you could give a sort of quick Reader's Digest summary of your story and what you're up to.
You want the podcast story or the Barry story? The Barry story is just too damn long.
Yeah, there's a lot in the Barry story.
I'll give you the podcast story. So following the book I wrote about the financial crisis, Bailout Nation, I become the personal finance column at the Washington Post. I've been writing publicly about markets, investing, the economy since the late 90s. My blog, thestreet.com, Washington Post, and then Bloomberg. And when Bloomberg was recruiting me, they're like, hey, how would you like a television show? And I had to kind of say, I really don't don't like financial television. Well, what would you like to do? And I'm getting a tour of their facilities. And the Bloomberg building is crazy cool. It's like the only purpose-built data slash media center in, you know, North America. Like there are other, you know, pure studios, but they're a giant data company with a media group attached. And I'm getting the tour in like 2013. And they say to me, if you don't want to do TV, what would you like to do? I said, I have this idea. I want to sit down with intelligent, accomplished people and ask them who they are and how they got that way and what can the rest of us learn from you. I don't care about your favorite stock pick or where you think the market will be in a year or what you think when the next Fed hike or cut is. Just who are you and how did you get that way? And I want to do it long form. And they said, long form, like 10, 15 minutes?
Yeah, right.
I'm like, no, long form, like 2 hours. And everybody laughed. And and then the takeaway was, look, to get an hour of broadcast radio, traffic, news, sports, weather, commercials, plus content, we need 32 minutes from you. If you go beyond that, hey, we'll put the whole thing up on, I don't even remember if Spotify was around then, but Apple and SoundCloud and wherever else we want to, we'll put it all up online and on the terminal, and we'll see if anybody listens. And now we get about 10 million listens a year. I've just done the 500th episode. The first, I want to say like the first 40, 25, something like that, before Mark Cuban didn't make it to Apple. And then it was afterwards Apple started keep pulling it. So it starts with number one is Mark Cuban, but he was like number 40 or 50. And so I've been doing that since coming up on the 10th year. July is this coming July 2024. Will be 10 years, and as I'm so fond of saying, it's the most fun I have all week.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I had forgotten about the fact that you were kind of doing long form before a lot of others were doing long form, and now it's sort of accepted orthodoxy that people will listen to long podcasts, and obviously Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson and some of these guys have proven that either there's men out there with 2.5 hours on their hand to listen to them each day, or some people have a lot longer commute than my walk down Second Avenue. But
to be fair, Howard Stern has been doing long form stuff for years and years and years, but nobody really thought of it as a podcast. First, it was WNBC, and then it was Sirius XM satellite,
terrestrial radio, and then Sirius. I still think most Howard Stern listeners were not hearing the whole show.
Probably true. You tune in for a couple of minutes, and this is you know, before the days of YouTube and before like whatever happens anywhere is accessible now. There's almost nothing out there. Somebody gives a speech, it shows up eventually. For the most part. So back then, there was sort of the buzz, hey, did you hear what Howard did with the woman and the speaker or some just crazy nonsense? And you would have to wait for the repeats to hear it. Like 6 months later, oh, I'm going to keep my ear open for when they're going to redo that. Or sometimes they would pull a best bit and reuse it. Although, to you know, again, I haven't listened to Howard in decades. But when I was going to grad school and taking the train the first semester, I would listen to Howard on the radio, and nobody was doing anything like that. He was totally hilarious. And fast forward a couple of decades, I think you can make the case that he's one of the best interviewers in all of media. He's become much more sophisticated and probing, and he has a way that he gets his guests to lower their guard. The way I do it is I just keep them talking long enough that you can't, it's hard to maintain that facade for 90 minutes, but he's become a great interviewer. By the way, when I pitched the podcast to Bloomberg a decade ago, the pitch was Mark Maron meets Charlie Rose. Maron had been doing a podcast. He's a stand-up comedian, and he was interviewing other stand-up comedians, and they weren't doing shtick. They were analyzing the craft of stand-up comedy. And I'm like, that's a great idea. Why don't we analyze the craft of business and investing and see what we can learn from people? And, you know, truth, again, truth be told, I would do this if nobody was watching. And, you know, people ask me, who's your audience? I am.
Yeah.
Right? Wait, Dick Thaler's going to sit down with me for 2 hours and tell me all about what it was like to win the Nobel and his research? I don't care if anybody listens. I'm going to have that conversation. And, you know, 500 of them later, people, are you going to run out of guests? I could do this for another century. You never run out of people.
That's probably, it's so funny you say that, how much we think alike on this stuff and have in common here. I think that the vast majority of Capitol Record episodes, I just started this 3 years ago.
Right.
And I've never used a booker. I've booked all the guests myself. I have a good Rolodex, and there's people I want to sit and have a conversation with, like yourself. But I would say that it's well over half the episodes that I honestly, not one time, even thought about the fact that we were recording. I just thought, I have a Zoom on right now. I'm talking to someone I want to talk to. And then when we're done, I guess I'm going to walk away from my computer and someone will hit stop. And then next thing I know, it'll be all packed and posted. And there's in some cases, it's people that I wouldn't necessarily have the opportunity to talk to at that level of depth apart from the format. So I think it's a really interesting insight. And it does seem to me, you mentioned the comedians. Sometimes I see little clips of these comedians I like on each other's show just talking. I find it fascinating. There's a certain authenticity to it, and it can be really humorous. It can also be very vulnerable, but it just makes for really good content. And I think those of us in money management, in some aspect of economics, policy, what have you, sitting around talking about this stuff with one another, I think you get far more candor with a guy in markets talking to a guy in markets than you do a TV anchor in a 3 minute set on the clock clip.
Anything that's time. So literally, here's the shtick before every podcast. I sit down and I say, all right, let me just give you some ground rules. We want you to sound good. We want to sound good. Everybody gets as many mulligans as they need. If you say something and you find yourself talking yourself into a corner, well, let's just do it again. Keep in mind, it's live to tape, keyword being tape, that if you don't like the way you sound, hey, let me take another shot at that. I'm not really communicating what I want. Oh, and this will go up in a couple of weeks, so just avoid yesterday, today, tomorrow, and stick with last month, next quarter, last year, and we're good to go. And, you know, if the answer is nope, well, that's the answer. And if the answer is a 10-minute soliloquy on the importance of understanding value when you're making a purchase and valuation of equity, have at it. You know, Aswan Damodaran went on these long jags about, you know, why people get so much wrong when it comes to valuing equities. And depending on the guest, I sometimes look at my job as give them a nudge, get them out of the way, get myself out of the way. So Michael Lewis, give him a nudge, get out of the way. The last one I did with him on Going Infinite, I had 4 hours worth of questions to squeeze into 75 minutes.
Yeah.
So I wanted to prevent him from going on. I know him well enough to know that if I let him just answer 5 questions, that's an hour and a half. But I had dozens. Chamath Palihapitiya during the, I want to say, pre-SPAC collapse. Like, I just gave him a nudge and stayed out of his way, and he just went off. Anytime you have someone who really has something they want to get off their chest, don't get in between the guest and a really good story.
Have you found that some of the more academic guys are a little harder to prod, and then some of the more performative guys, they're a little, you know, a guy like Michael Lewis is such a ridiculously gifted author. But he also is a real veteran in the public eye, and he seems to have no problem at all getting going, talking. He just is a very effective communicator. But I found some of the more professorial types sometimes they take succinctness to a whole new level.
So my I've had a lot of academics on, a lot of professors, a lot of Nobel laureates, and my general approach to dealing with someone like that is to become a subject matter expert on them and the topic they write. Now, with some people who are super prolific, like I've had authors on who have 20 books. I'm not going to read 20 books for a podcast, but I'll read the most recent book. This week is Zeke Fox, whose crypto book, Number Go Up, is just unbelievable. Whereas Michael Lewis's Going Infinite is this fascinating narrative story about this wacky dude. Zeke Fox is an investigative reporter, and he's just all over the world pointing out all these various crypto frauds and the people who have been arrested. And the ironic part is, in that book, the focus is proving Tether, the stablecoin, is a fraud. And it turns out Tether appears to be perfectly legit. It's still a dollar. It's nobody has ever been able to show they don't have the money they claim. But along the way, he proves all these other things are just useless or scam. ICOs, 80% of initial coin offerings are scams. And, you know, he just goes through so much stuff, and the book is amazing. So that's one book. So I have to become an expert on that book. But someone like a Bob Shiller, a Robert Cialdini, go down the list, Meyer Statman, Thomas Gilovich, David Dunning. I end up reading two or three books for guys like that. I'm typically inviting them because I like and I'm familiar with their work. And then I'll read a bunch of white papers, and I'll give a bunch of things to one of my researchers and basically say, get me a summation of everything this guy has written in the past 5 years. And I don't need them to spend 100 hours reading everything. It's like a couple hours of just going through 50 papers and giving me a bullet point. Sometimes it's just cut and paste, but let me get up to speed in addition to everything I've read. For the sake of completeness, tell me what's important elsewhere.
When Patricia tried to donate to a conservative organization through her donor advised fund, her request was denied. Why? Because they said she was trying to give to a hate group. That's why she switched to Waterstone, a donor-advised fund dedicated to upholding Judeo-Christian values. Waterstone is unique in the world of donor-advised funds. It accepts gifts of cash as well as real estate, business interest, oil, and more. They can help you receive an immediate tax deduction and make a difference for the charity of your choosing. With its charitable pooled trust, you can even generate a guaranteed income stream from your charitable giving. Waterstone strictly adheres to a Christian statement of faith, including a pro-life declaration, does not give to charities that contradict those values. Waterstone is trusted by so many men and women of conviction that they give $10 million per month in charitable grants. They can work with you or your financial advisor to make a giving strategy that fits your needs. Contact Waterstone's Giving Strategies team today for more information by visiting waterstone.org. That's waterstone.org.
So with this particular podcast, obviously yours is domiciled at Bloomberg, which is a media conglomerate that is specific in the world of finance.
Yes.
You may notice as we're recording, we have video on, even though our people listening don't see video. I have Bloomberg TV on behind me. I appreciate, I think, a little bit more sobered tone and tenor in their television background than some of the other alternatives. But the Bloomberg world is, for all practical purposes, pretty highly regarded in financial industry. And there's probably a lot of B2B listeners, people like myself listen to your podcast, other people in the business listen. I have at National Review a ecosystem that is intentionally more ideological, an outreach, I guess, of a particular worldview, more conservative politically, and I think more attempting to be serious on the right in a time when many on the right are not very serious. A very performative, a very populist tone has taken over much of Republican politics. And I still believe that Bill Buckley and National Review represent, I think, something very iconoclastic. And these days, they're having to fight to preserve what it means to be a conservative. as much as they're having to fight, you know, what used to be the battle to sort of save America from the left, so to speak. Do you find your podcast becoming ideological at times, or do you prefer to keep it in a more objective financial discussion that veers away from some of these matters of politics, culture, and ideology?
Wow, that's really a complex question. Let me see if I can rise to the occasion. So I have had people on who are from government. Sheila Bair at the FDIC is a perfect example, but are not political. The former, drawing a blank on his name, the former head of the CIA, Jack Devine, I had on. Fascinating guy, clearly a political element there. Probably the most political, and I'm not talking about people who every now and then drop some bomb about something that's wholly unexpected. There's just a run of people who have real issues with the Fed, and they've kind of politicized that. The two most purely political people I've had on, one was because it was timely, was Rick Wilson, who did the book. I think he did Everything Trump Touches Dies. Is that right? Yeah, that was Rick Wilson. But I had him on in like late 2016, and the same with Bruce Bartlett, a former Reagan administration person. Bruce is more economic and finance, but he certainly had a lot to say about politics. More recently, I, through like just the weirdest set of dumb coincidences, ended up getting Gary Cohn, former president and COO of Goldman Sachs and Donald Trump's first director of economic policy. I think he was chair of the...
Before Kudlow, he was the head of the National Economic Council.
Right. And you know, it was funny because as I'm doing my prep and my research for him, I start finding things and I'm like, damn it, I don't want to make this a political discussion. Here's the guy who essentially was the driving force behind the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. And here's also the guy who was there when you know, at least in the beginning, when deficits started to rise. He was gone by the time they exploded under COVID. So I got to spend 2 hours asking him questions, of which we probably spent 30 or 40 minutes talking about the history of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, what the thinking was behind it, how they managed to get it through Congress. And here's a guy who, how has nobody really had this conversation with him in depth before? It's kind of shocking because, you know, I am not a Trump fan, but you cannot help but look at the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and say that is a major piece of legislation which had a substantial change on tax policy on a national basis, tax policy on a state-by-state basis. And I'm capable of being objective enough to say, whether I like it or dislike it, it doesn't matter. It's significant, and let's talk to its architect. And I thought that was fascinating. And then I also asked him, hey, there was a great opportunity to refinance U.S. debt at, you know, really low rates, maybe even do a 50-year bond. Why did we not do that? And by the way, Trump was arguably the third president who had that opportunity and missed it. And he said he offered it up to the president. The president said, great, move forward. And, you know, it just kind of died on the vine. Wasn't a priority.
You know, it's interesting because what I've learned, and we talked about this when you and I had lunch in the city recently, both of us have a longstanding relationship with Larry Kudlow. He continues to be one of my closest friends. He's been on this podcast several times. I'm on his TV show all the time. And Larry and I have a very close personal relationship. You used to be on his show back at CNBC quite a bit. It's one of the first... One of the first introductions I had to you was on his old show back at CNBC. So we both know Larry well. And I have talked to Larry about this. And I have people, I won't say names, that I'm connected to, very close to Mnuchin at Treasury. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how some presidents had a very CEA heavy administration, the Council of Economic Advisors, and some had a very NEC heavy, the National Economic Council. Greenspan was Gerald Ford's head of his CEA. And then for Trump, he had Kevin Hassett at CEA and Gary Cohn at NEC. Obama had Larry Summers at NEC, who had been, you know, Clinton's Treasury Secretary and was a very significant center-left kind of neo-Keynesian economic policy wonk for through several administrations. And for whatever reason, there's different administrations that kind of end up getting more influenced by one of these bureaus than another. And I think that in that case, it's so funny when you say Trump was for it. I know Trump didn't care about the details
right.
of almost anything.
Right, right.
And
That sounds good. Go do that. And then no follow-up, no anything.
I don't say that as a compliment, but I also, in this case, don't necessarily mean it as a criticism. It's more just a descriptive fact about his leadership and managerial style.
Right.
The understanding I get in that issue, you brought up with Gary Cohn, and I would be surprised if that was much in Gary Cohn's portfolio. But my understanding is that Mnuchin really liked the idea, drove it a bit, and then they just didn't pull it across the finish line. And then during 2020, when rates were, they probably could have issued tens of billions of dollars. I don't think they could have gotten hundreds of billions.
I think it could have been 100-year bonds, and people would have been happy to pay
50 and very likely right. 100. And people say, would there have been investor appetite? And I know there would have been.
Absolutely. I'm shocked you get pushback on that.
It would have been a cash carry instrument of absolutely unspeakable leverage as a deflationary hedge.
Right.
Where you're paying dollar for dollar in the cash market for it. And right now, if they had issued 50-year debt at about 3% in 2020, that would be trading at about 50 cents on the dollar. It would be just a beautiful place for either wealth managers like us or hedge funds
right.
to go buy some deflationary hedge.
Right, and lock a long-term rate in at a very low price. You know the funny thing
the
is—
the issue is they don't need to worry about what the benefits would be to financial markets.
Right.
The benefit would be to them as a borrower.
And I got pushback on that when I posted something on Twitter, and it's like, listen, it's not the Treasury Department's job to hold the hands of bond buyers. If there's an appetite for 50-year bonds at 3.5% when Fed funds rate is zero and the U.S. Treasury is yielding 1.5, your job is to do it. So that was one pushback. And the other pushback was, well, you're just encouraging more debt. And I'm like, no, you're not. This is not future spending. This is money that was already spent and financing. You're saying when rates drop, homeowners should refinance their home because it'll just encourage more spending. It's put your ideology aside.
Well, that's not even a good that's not even a good ideological argument. I want less spending. I want less debt, and I'd favor a more favorable term structure to the debt.
Stop being so rational. No one's gonna take you seriously anymore.
That's
but by the way, the fascinating thing about the various admin economic advisors you mentioned, two of my least favorite guys in terms of their policy, Larry Summers and Kevin Hassett. I think both of them have been from the left and the right. So I have this pet theory, and this is very ageist of me as a guy who's in his 60s, but the economists who came of age in the 70s and 80s in that inflationary, stagflation, Volcker era, their models of the world and their models of inflation seem to be wildly outdated. Yeah. And, you know, when I interviewed Jeremy Siegel early in 21, just after we kind of reopened, and he said, hey, all this fiscal spending is going to cause a giant surge in inflation, and nobody paid attention to him. Nobody took him seriously.
Now, of course, Summers was all over that, right? And Summers really
later to the party. He was against a big fiscal stimulus under Obama in response to the financial crisis, and you can make a pretty decent argument that whenever there is a crisis in America, the response has been Keynesian fiscal stimulus And we know that playbook. We did it following the Depression. We did it in World War II. We did it, you know, time and again. We did it during 9/11. We did it during the pandemic. The one time we kind of skipped it, yeah, there was a small infrastructure build out and a temporary extension of unemployment insurance and a temporary tax cut. But it was nothing like, hey, the CARES Act one under President Trump was the biggest fiscal stimulus since the Great Depression. It was more than 10% of GDP. CARES Act two was another $800 billion also under Trump. When you talk about the Tax Cuts and Job Act of 2017, that's over 10 years. So if it's $3 trillion over 10 years, okay, but that's, you know, $300 billion a year is a fairly modest number. Then you move to the next. I'm going to pull this up on my screen because I have this great table I created for a quarterly call for clients where we mapped out all of the recent, we called it Understanding Investing Regime Change. So TCJA, $3 trillion over 10 years, CARES Act 1, $2 trillion, CARES Act 2 called the HEALS Act COVID Release, $1.1 trillion, CARES Act 3, $800 billion. American Rescue Plan, $1.9 trillion. Bipartisan Infrastructure, $1.2 trillion, although that's over 10 years. CHIPS and Science Act, $300 billion over 10 years. Inflation Reduction Act, $891. That's over 10 years. You know, you look at the New Deal, you know, on an inflation-adjusted basis, that was about 12.6% of GDP on inflation-adjusted basis, $835 billion, in a time when government was much smaller. And even the Marshall Plan, again, historically inflation-adjusted, $154 billion in aid to rebuild Europe. When I talk about – so here's where politics gets fascinating. Everybody wants to get into the argument of is this – and some of those numbers, by the way – about half of some of those numbers were already allocated and they were lumped in under a new policy with more money. People want to argue about, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? But, you know, I find a lot of these hedge fund managers and these mutual fund managers, they're chin rubbers. They scratch their chin and they should be having a clove cigarette at Reggio's outside of NYU on McDougal Street and philosophize. And I always look at that as, that's not my job. My job is to guide clients to manage risk and invest money. The question for me isn't, is the Tax Cuts and Job Act good or bad? The question is, as professionally, what does this mean for your portfolio? And I think lots of people in our business forget that.
Well, it's you're exactly right. I think that I feel a little bit blessed as a very opinionated guy, as a very, you know, philosophical guy. I don't do the clove cigarette thing, and I don't much like hanging out with people outside NYU rubbing my chin, but I'm sort of cursed a little bit with having thoughts about the way the world ought to be. And yet I feel that if I could pinpoint one area that has made the biggest difference in my professional success, it's being able to separate that from what is. What ought to be and what is, the prescriptive and the descriptive, and that I constantly am saying to clients, we're now managing just a whisker short of $5 billion, the vast majority of which are clients who largely see the world somewhat similar to, adjacent to, the way I do. Having to constantly explain to them how our job is to manage their money for what the world is, not for what we want it to be, and how those two things sometimes can be very different and can feel very frustrating. That's, I think, inescapable part of human nature. There is a sense in which if a guy you don't like is president, you assume the stock market will go down. And if there's a guy you do like as president, you assume the stock market will go up. And you could take that same thinking and that same dynamic and apply it to many other things. Your optimism about a jobs report, your optimism about GDP. But for me to have to say, I don't care if there's a Republican or Democrat, I think we're going to run deficits that are too high for what I want to be, and that they are going to take numbers, take decimal points off of future expected growth. And that's a nonpartisan comment. Now, I could be right or wrong about what I believe the impact of excessive government indebtedness is to future GDP growth. But my point to clients is it's not political. And that's a hard thing for people to do. And it's harder now than it was 20 years ago, because I think there were a lot of Democrats that loved what was happening to the stock market under Reagan. And there were a lot of Republicans that loved what was happening to the stock market under Clinton. But there were Republicans that hated the stock market going up under Obama. And there were Democrats that hated the stock market going up under Trump. And I that's different. The people are rooting against their own economic well-being at times. I find it fascinating.
So I'm so glad you brought that up, because as you were speaking, I was looking for a presentation I did years ago after the Obama administration ended, and I'm still scrolling through looking for this. Look, my very first column for the Washington Post was, "Here's why investing in politics don't mix." That was literally my first column, and now I'm looking for, and I'll find it. I'm looking for this presentation on behavioral finance that I've done over the years, and essentially, the takeaway was, when George W. Bush got elected, all my hedge fund buddies came out and said, this guy Bush, he's going to blow up the deficit. He's going to give money away to the rich, blah, blah, blah. And they missed a 92% rally off of those March 03 lows. And then Bush serves two terms and Obama gets elected. I have a vivid recollection of, I want to say it was either February or March 2009, Obama is going to destroy the Dow. That was in the Washington, the Wall Street Journal. And if you give me a minute, I'll remember who wrote it.
Which, by the way, writing it in March of 09, from November of 08 when he was elected to March of 09, the Dow dropped another 4,000 points. So that was a really bold call by March of 09.
Right. It was right before the lows. P.S., you know what followed after March of 09? One of the greatest rallies of our lifetime. Yeah. And so is this it? Was this that Forbes? Maybe this is it. I'll dig it. Here it is. Politics and, oh, no, the Bush tax cuts are going to be terrible for the market. 2003. Market rallies, 2003 tax cuts are $1 trillion in stimulus, market up 90% over the next 4 years. How did that political trade work out for you?
Yeah.
And then it was, Obama is a Kenyan Muslim socialist, stay out of the markets at all cost, deeply oversold, FASB 157, ZERP QE, 108% over the next 36 months. And those sort of things are just, I'll share this PDF with you if you like. Those sort of things are just, you know, like you, I have very strong opinions as make me philosopher king, benevolent dictator, and I have a lot of changes I'll implement and the world will be a lot better. But ask me how you should be investing, and it's like all of those opinions go out the window. And now let's just talk about a robust portfolio that can withstand volatility, that will meet your financial goals and be able to let you sleep at night. You know, I'm fond of saying the best portfolio isn't the one that generates the highest returns. It's the one that you don't panic out of because you can't take the pain anymore.
I think the only thing I might word a little differently, it still may be that we're kind of saying something identical, but I don't know that I would even have to say that the things I believe in, the ideals or what I would be if I were, what did you say, benevolent king for a day?
Benevolent dictator, philosopher king.
All of those things necessarily would go out the window. It's more that I separate the way in which those things are thought of prescriptively from the way in which I invest descriptively. And so I don't pretend to be agnostic. I just acknowledge that what I want is different than what is, right? And the other piece to this too is the Fed. If I were to say, I'm not going to tell you the political party, I'm not going to tell you if the guy's Kenyan, Muslim, left wing, right wing, and the worst insult I could give him, I'm not even going to tell you if he went to Harvard or not. Okay. So all I'm going to say is that we're going to have a president, and while that person is president, the market is going to start off at about 11 times earnings, and that then there is going to be $4 trillion of money creation and a four-year period of 0% discount rate at the risk-free rate. Do you need to know the political ideology of that person to know what will happen to markets over that period of time?
So I had this wonderful conversation on a pretty much that topic with Jim Bianco in mid-2009. So a little history. Wrote a piece back in end of 2006 about just a thought experiment based on a Reinhart and Rogoff white paper. They looked at five financial crises around the world, Mexico, Sweden, Japan, the Great Depression, the U.S. I never remember the fifth one. And by the way, that paper eventually became This Time is Different, 800 Years of Financial Folly. And one of the things they find is when there's a debt driven financial crisis, real estate loses about a third of its value. So I did this thought experiment. What happens if real estate loses a third of its value? What does that mean for the Dow, which was about 13,000 at the time? And I basically just revert, you know, the Dow is a weird numeric index, but it was 30 stocks were easier to do than 500. So I just kind of reverse engineered the earnings and came up with a number that ended up being 6,800, Dow 6,800. And it was like the last paragraph. It wasn't even the headline. It was just a throwaway. It's all anybody wanted to talk about. Larry has me on the show. Yeah. Oh, they use a number in the annual forecast for Business Week. Nobody's even close to me. Like everybody is 14, 18, 20,000. I'm 6,800. And for a year, I was Barry the idiot. And then, you know, 08 rolls around and I wasn't such an idiot. But the idea of any time the market is cut in half, that's a great entry point for equities. And I'm discussing, so 13,000 to 6,100. I don't know if we're going to 4,000. Don't care. U.S. markets cut in half, I'm a buyer. Broad markets, if it's a sector like the NASDAQ was in 2000, well, you buy down 50%. If you like it down 50%, you're going to love it down 81%. But Bianco and I are having this conversation, and I'm, you know, we're the two blind guys describing the elephant. I'm talking about every sentiment indicator I looked at in March is as pinned as it ever gets. The market is cut in half, and I went on Yahoo TV and say, cover your shorts and go long here. But a few months later, we're talking about all the pushback to the rally. And Bianco was the first guy who says to me, don't care about the politics. Don't care about what people think of the Fed. When the Fed takes rates to zero and creates trillions of dollars in assets, money has nowhere to go but equities. And yeah, that's pure confirmation bias on my part, but I'm looking at it from a somewhat different perspective. Valuations never got as cheap as they did in 82 because then rates and inflation were so much lower, they can't get that cheap. It wasn't going to happen. And no matter where you're starting from, you know, the old joke used to be a billion here, a billion there. Well, a trillion here and a trillion there. And that's real money, and that finds its way into risk assets.
Well, you know, my last book was called There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths. And obviously that title comes from a famous essay Milton Friedman, who is one of my economic heroes, wrote. Milton did write a book by that name, and he didn't even make up the term. But the kind of obscure origins of this concept, There's No Free Lunch, just sort of dealing with the economic laws of scarcity and trade-offs and whatnot. But what I think I've done is, with a lot of clients, done too good of a job explaining to them the economic issues, where I would say the Fed is doing this and this, and it's going to mean this for asset prices. And then the clients can say, yeah, but what's the trade-off? And to Bianca's point in your guys' argument about a market halved in 09 and what was clearly at that point, whether we were a day away, a month away, or 6 months away, we were at a washout of valuations and a rally of a lifetime was coming.
Generational low, for sure.
And if Vladimir Lenin had been the president of the United States, that market was going to rally violently. And I think that, no pun intended, rally violently. I think the problem is I can believe two things at once, and it's hard for some to do this. I can say there's a cost to years of excessive easy monetary policy. There's a cost to years of excessive government debt, yet that is not something that capital markets are going to be adjusting immediately. And in fact, it's entirely possible, for good or for bad, that the price will not be borne by those of us who own assets. That the price will be borne in lower wage growth, in lower economic growth, and in a number of different things that kind of reallocate resources within the economy. And as it turns out, I think 15 years later, there's a lot I would disagree with about what has been done in both fiscal and monetary. There's certain things I'd be very supportive of what's been done in fiscal and monetary. But I don't think anyone can deny that most of the things that have happened have worked out better for people like you and me.
Oh, no doubt about that. So there's a lot to unpack there. Let me throw a few things at you. First, I have a vivid recollection on the descriptive prescriptive discussion. I wrote a piece, I don't know, 10 years ago called Where Sea Monsters Live. You know, your job is not to rage against the sea. Your job is not to strap yourself to the bow of the ship and argue with the storm. Your job is to safely navigate your passengers to safe harbor. And I think people in our industry, because of the daily noise machine and because just how much fun it is to BS about politics, people very often lose sight of that. And I want people to realize that no matter what your views are, or at least should be, no matter what your views are of the world and where it's wrong and right, I think that when you scrub up and put on your gloves and surgical mask and go into surgery, you're doing the very best surgery you can based on the latest medicinal sciences. And likewise, when I put on my asset allocator hat, when I put on my advisor hat, I go in and saying, I'll give you a perfect example. So the night before the 2016 presidential election, I do these quarterly conference calls for clients, and every now and then I'll send out a special note in addition to all the content we create in-house. And the night before the election, I wrote up this whole thing about no matter who wins, no matter what happens, who's in the White House doesn't affect your portfolio, right? It may dominate television, it may dominate the media, but in the real world, what dominates is the economic activity of everybody getting up in the morning, dressing their kids, sending them off to school, showering, getting dressed, going off to work. That $22 trillion economic economy, that $22 trillion American economy, what proclamation comes from or from this president, or what tweet came from the last president is irrelevant. So I wrote up this whole 500-word letter, and I left the last paragraph blank because I wasn't sure who was going to win. Right? The odds favored Hillary, but there was still like this chance. And keep in mind, Trump kind of barely snuck in through a handful of states by a modest amount of in key swing states, less than the margin that Jill Stein got. Like her 1.5% was the difference in him winning. And I knew that was
80,000 votes between four states.
Right, I knew that was a mathematical possibility, so I didn't want to send this out. I'm not a big believer in forecasts anyway, but I really wanted to be comfortable that what I was sending out was good advice to clients. And so what I filled in on that last paragraph is, all right, so good news, bad news. The bad news is many of your favorite subjects, favorite topics are for some clients, are going to be negatively impacted. We'll probably see changes in laws on abortion and judges, and don't expect a whole lot of motion on global warming and the environment. However, you should expect a lot of fiscal stimulus and you should expect a lot of tax cuts. Talk to us about helping you use your philanthropy to give to the issues you want. And I really tried to play it as down the middle as I possibly could in saying, whether you like the outcome or don't, whether your view of what's going to happen changes or not, okay, so the worst case scenario is you're going to have more money in your pocket. If you really believe these issues are important, well, we'll help you figure out ways to get appreciated stock to these philanthropies and benefit your own tax circumstances rather than relying on the government to do it. Guess what? Now you can do it. And it was surprisingly well received by people both left of center and right of center. And one of our most conservative clients writes back and says, you know, my buddy said you're a crazy lefty. He goes, you're the most moderate person of any person I deal with. And in finance, everybody is either, you know, at one extreme or it's all politics. And your message is ignore the politics. Just look at the data.
Well, and it's a wonderful thing about financial markets. I believe that in all of reality, there is truth, and that there is something about financial markets that adds to the empirical truthfulness of things, incentives that really bring about a bit more pure understanding of the world. And so last week on the podcast, I had the dean of the business school at Catholic University of America, and he had made the comment that cash flows don't lie, and that these days where there's so many issues about truth, about facts, about reality. There's these great big philosophical ambiguities people are wrestling with. And I think to some degree, financial markets don't, because both the data, as you point out, and the incentives really work against that. It's very hard to make money betting against reality. And there is just some element to that. You know, people are still subject to biases. They're still subject to behavioral mistakes. And yet, at the end of the day, the truth sort of wins out. And certainly when it comes down to just return on investment, cash flows become king again. Barry, I would love to have you back on the podcast. I'd love to continue our conversation, whether we're recording or not. I love talking with you.
Sure.
Love what you're doing. And I think for a lot of our listeners, it's going to be interesting because we have theologians, we have philosophers, we have, you know, people out of the Trump or Reagan or Bush administrations. I mean, it's, I'm a right-wing guy, but I have just as many friends in your orbit ideologically as I do in my orbit. And I think that there's something about that that makes for happier living.
You know, I'll leave you with this last thought when you talk about fighting reality. The feedback loop in investing is so much faster than the feedback loop in politics.
That's right.
You could be right or wrong about monetary stimulus, fiscal stimulus, social security, deficits. You'll find out a couple of decades from now if you were wrong. It's rare when you are wrong in markets that the feedback loop takes much longer than a year. And yeah. In fact, even heading into the financial crisis, you know, until it started showing up in mortgages that were defaulting, which then led to securitized products that had a high level of default, which then led to the derivative insurance on that had big payouts, that mechanism took a good couple of years before the warnings came true. And once the ice was broken, everything unraveled pretty quickly. But just because you see a storm coming doesn't mean the storm is going to be here anytime soon. And that's true for long or short stocks, long or short markets, whatever you feel about bonds. Normally, the feedback loop in markets is just so much faster than in politics. And people, even if it's not immediate, it's certainly not decades. And that's the big difference.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Love the insight. Love hearing you. I'm going to put some of these links and things to your information, including the Bloomberg podcast, in our show notes. And I'll look forward to having another conversation with you soon, Barry.
Got a new project coming out in January. Love to come back and tell you about it.
We will make that happen. Thanks so much. Well, I regret that it had to end up getting cut a little short there. We ran up against our timeline, and yet I enjoyed the whole conversation. You could probably tell out of there where there's just so much Barry and I have in common, and a lot of conversation that I think is really helpful, fruitful. There's certain areas that we could have delved into deeper that we may not see exactly eye to eye, but I just think that he has a lot of wonderful insights. And I think the underlying point Barry was making, even if coming at it from a slightly different direction, is an identical point I make, that many times people's inability to distinguish between what is and what ought to be is a really dangerous failure when it comes to financial markets. And Barry and I might disagree about what ought to be, but we don't disagree that there is a difference between what ought to be and what is. And I appreciated a lot of his insights he shared today. I hope you did too. I hope you remain faithfully committed to the cause of a free and virtuous society. I know that's what we are committed to here at National Review's Capital Record. Thanks for listening and doing your part to help us grow this podcast as listeners and the impact it can have towards that very aim of a free and virtuous society. Take care.
Selling smoothies is what I do, but for small business insurance, I chose my State Farm agent. He's a small business owner, too, so he knew how to help me personalize my policies. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to an agent today.